I'm not sure if I always do this, but when I come here, I like to personally acknowledge the Whadjuk people of the Noongar Nation, and particularly today, I want to acknowledge one of the elders of this area who's passed quite recently. Her name is Doolin Alicia Eats, and some of you may know her, of course. And she is a very beautiful woman and a deeply committed Christian and deeply committed to the Indigenous people. And she has traditional stories of her great-grandmothers of this area, and it was a beautiful thing to have her share some of those stories, just a few of them, with me during my interactions with her. It's just a beautiful thing to actually acknowledge that we had the opportunity to know and to live with Doolin Alicia and to acknowledge her and her husband Walter in his time of grief. I also don't know if this always happens to me, but I said the date suited me better to come on the 14th than the 28th. I'm sorry to leave you in the lurch. And then I opened up the readings and I thought, oh my goodness. Perhaps I'll swap back. Anyway, here we go. Awful readings. Fear of the unknown and fear of missing out. I know the acronym for that now. Fear of losing family, fear of losing my life, fear of losing our lives, fear of being ostracised. It never left me in all of my advocacy work, neither in the war zones or warlike zones in West Papua, in Sri Lanka or East Timor. And that's a big theme of today's readings. The author of Hebrews was writing to a community who were thinking about giving up their faith. It was too hard. They were just thinking of sliding back into the mainstream community. They were ostracized from their families, not just their nuclear family, as we often think about family, but their extended family, which was their whole community, in order to follow this Jesus. In some ways, this is a similar outcome for those who seek asylum, some of the bravest people who I've come across. Some of you know my association with CARAD. I've been privileged to work with people who've sought refuge and succour from Australia in my work in both the UCA and in CARAD. CARAD turned 22 this year. We never imagined we'd be still going. I remember when we established CARAD, talking to the Minister for Immigration at the time. Some of you who are old as me or older might remember Mr. Ruddock. He said, well, I don't think that we're going to be able to persist with this policy for too long because the Australian people won't stand for it. Anyway, we thought the aberration of the policies of the Australian government brought in 1999-2000 would soon be overturned when people heard the true story of refugee people. But no, these policies got progressively worse, and with a few blips of exceptions along the way, when sometimes some people's consciences were pricked. You're probably all well informed about refugees and, like me, are hopeful of some resolution in this term of government. And I hope that none of us are disappointed. Currently at CARAD, we're assisting about 200 people. I feel like saying, still, even now, at the beginning of that sentence. Many people are still seeking resolution of their temporary status, or even more insecurely, bridging visa status. These kinds of visas leave people in limbo for extended periods of time, with families in insecure, informal refugee camps, often illegally in third countries, who have not signed the refugee conventions, so who are subject to arbitrary injustices, and who have no rights to work, so can lose their jobs at any moment they're challenged, no rights to health care in those countries, so are subject to the vagaries of pro bono health care. Countries such as Turkey, Jordan, Pakistan, Indonesia, Syria, Uganda, southern Sudan, and Lebanon carry many more times than their fair share of refugees worldwide. There was a great graphic that we produced probably about 2010, which had what 100 people and represented as a piece of it the tiny percentage of the world's refugees that Australia was responsible for, even while telling the Australian public that we were generous in our refugee intake. We're not generous on a worldwide scale. We're not even generous compared to the other Western countries. We are very minor. We worked out a few years ago that if Australia took its fair share of refugees worldwide, we would take around about 64,000 people. Well, we currently take between 12 and 13, and over the last few years, while we've had COVID, we've actually taken even less. But people in Australia who've actually made it to Australia are also treated very poorly by our government. Every time we make a little progress from the NGO and the church's point of view about justice for refugees, something else falls off the other end. And this continued trauma of uncertainty is significant in its impact on some of the most vulnerable in our community. We're still only the tiniest number compared to the international scene, but we still struggle as a country to have a compassionate response to refugees. Perhaps it's a hangover of our dispossession of the Indigenous people of this land, but perhaps that's a subject for another day. One of the commentators on the Gospel of Luke in the reading, Michaela Brazzese, has reflected about needing to see the full story. Who among us can see the whole truth? Who among us can most faithfully interpret the scriptures? And who is the most loyal in applying the message of the good news in real life? The readings we've had today seem really hard to me. I might have mentioned that before. But perhaps easier to understand if we approach from the point of view that we don't fully see the whole picture as an individual, and that we need each other to help us to see the whole. I was excited to see Diana Butler Bass's presentation to the Wild Goose Conference earlier this year. She told in that presentation of a PhD student she'd previously mentored researching the papyrus from about 500 in the Common Era, who has just made what is thought to be a major discovery about Mary. That's Mary Magdalene. I won't tell you the story now, but it involves a corrected, in inverted commas, papyrus. So on the original papyrus, there's some correction from a later time, which has then informed scholars for the following 1,500 approximately years. Astonishing news and an example of not seeing the whole picture. And it's now published, and you can look up this where I got my information from initially on Diana's website. It's Diana Butler Bass at www.mary.com, and the talk is called Mary the Tower. It did my feminist theology heart good. Michaela Brazzazi, in her commentary on the lection for this week, and who I referenced earlier, goes on to postulate that the Luke passage may have the meaning that Jesus wanted us to understand, that we as individuals, as individual churches or denominations, can't get to God alone. She goes on to say that other visions of God are necessary, and that in the gathering we form, as the Hebrew says, so great a cloud of witnesses. And when we value and respect instead of reject what divides us, we spare any one person or community from trying to speak exclusively for God. I was thinking about the way we are influenced by the media in Australia, the way the Australian community was captured by the attempt, successful attempt as it happened, to strike fear into people about the people arriving by boats via people smugglers. Even the word people smugglers is a challenge. I've met quite a few people who've been labelled by that people smuggler label, one of whom was a 16-year-old boy who just happened to be more computer literate than everybody else. So he helped with the translation that needed to be made, and he helped with the finding of the directions because he knew how to use a GPS. He's labelled a people smuggler and was initially jailed, finally released. How the debate was framed by politicians and shock media types, when serious people spoke out against this approach, we were verbally accused as wanting to see people drowned. Of course, those religious communities and human rights activists were never advocating that, but saying, you know, if you had a processing centre in Indonesia, if you negotiated with Indonesia very carefully, you would be able to process people before they got on the boats. Wouldn't that be an interesting challenge for us? It wasn't a narrative that suited the Australian political scene at the time, and some of those who knew better in Australian politics were too scared. They were fearful. I couldn't understand how any Christian politician could hold that kind of line. Nevertheless, they did. Restoration of the previous compassionate assessment of the Vietnam and Cambodian crisis would have helped the thousands of people who were desperately fleeing wars that the West had fermented. And not offshore, endless detention and cruel boat turnbacks. I remember people telling me on so many occasions, especially in the UCA, and I quote, I didn't know what people were fleeing from. Well, maybe the bombs that America and Australia are dropping on them. Maybe the same Taliban that we're fighting against. I didn't understand their story, people said. And then a little bit later, while I visited Sri Lanka after the defeat of the Tamil Tigers and witnessed the burning of the bones of the murdered thousands of people, so there was no DNA evidence, I was ignorant enough, as many of us are when we go to these challenging places, to ask the question, why are there all these burning off? Why are all these fires here? And that's the answer. Because they are burning the bones of our families, and in order to destroy the DNA so we can't count the number of people who were murdered here at the end of that awful war. People in Australia had difficulty believing that story. Well, there's a good government in Sri Lanka now. We could send refugees back there. It's perfectly safe for them. People in Australia had difficulty even believing that story. Not understanding is at the heart of many of our things, many of our problems. And not understanding is why the Nadasalam family were taken from their town of Bilawila in Queensland to be deported to Sri Lanka with two small children, 4 a.m. in the morning. It is why people were imprisoned illegally in the detention camps, both within Australian territory and offshore, and is because Australians were told a false story that was easy for us to believe, as the other is not us. The othering of refugees is just a technique that is used worldwide to describe people of disadvantaged. We make the gypsies other in the 18th century. We make the Jews other in Nazi Germany. This is humanity's story. It's because Australians were told these false stories, it was easy for us to believe, because the other is not us. The granting of permanent visas to the Bilawila family is a great tribute to a small band of ordinary Australians who understood the humanity of the family. It is a fabulous outcome for those children and their parents. But all people and families in this same circumstances should be granted permanent visas and pathways to citizenship. There are about 1,500 people in this circumstance in Australia and 300 or so in offshore places in Nauru and Papua New Guinea. Given our shortage of people for critical roles in aged care and the building industries, and not to mention agriculture, it would not be a hardship for Australia to end this suffering. This othering of people, which we as a society of the fairly privileged are able to do, must be countered. We must be telling the other side of the story so people understand. Perhaps it's our anthropology that means we're like this, but it isn't the community God envisioned. The ground that's prepared on the hill, getting the right sunlight for the vineyard, it is not what God imagines for the community of God, that there will be sour grapes and unharvestable terror. God envisions for us a fruitful harvest, a community that is fruitful. And it is the challenge of today's readings, the call to be the thoughtful people of faith who stand up to the prevailing norms of society, to be a community of inclusion and love, because we are called to be a welcoming community and a community which demonstrates an inbreaking of the realm of God with us. Amen.
Anyone have any questions?
I love that you still do this. I feel sad that we don't do that at my community church.
Without wanting to bash America. I remember when I was growing up, America was a place that I thought, oh, wow, that's a magical place. I want to go there. I want to be there. And in the last 10, 20 years, that's the last place I want to be. But part of what I think that I've realized, part of what I thought it was the quote from the base of the Statue of Liberty.
Mm.
And I haven't...
Welcome your people.
Yeah, send me your poor and dispossessed. Send me your refugees.
Mm.
And I think to me that was the ideal of what America used to be. And that to me is what I see as a big contrast with particularly Australia's refugee policy, and it feels to me like that's actually what I would like us to be like, you know, welcoming.
We went there for a little while in the 1970s in Australia, but we didn't start with the basis of it. The Constitution is an exclusionary document. It started that way we were always worried about the invasion of the Chinese, and the Chinese were quite wealthy and powerful at the turn of the 19th century. And when the Constitution in Australia was made, it was for that kind of purpose. Sorry.
Yeah. You began your talk about fear, and fear is that seems at the base of the Australian response. And you were, I think, very generous in your terminology. I'd say we're mean. We are. You know, we are so blessed with so much, and not everyone in Australia is blessed with as much as perhaps we have here in this room, and even in this room there are differing amounts that we all enjoy. But at the heart of it is this fear that we will lose and that our lifestyle will somehow be less, and how we address that fundamental fear and greed that rests within us as a nation, I think, is something to ponder. Sorry.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. It is, a fear is at the base of that exclusion, and why we need to make that person or that group of people the other is because we're afraid. It is scary to have your values challenged, to have your culture challenged, to share in that deep cultural way with other people, and it's very very confronting. Yeah.
I don't have a question, Rosemary, but I just, for me, thank you for saying what you've said. It's just unbelievably sobering to hear it stated as you've stated it. It leaves a heaviness. So it's not comfortable, but thank you.
Yes, that discomforting thing is a challenge, isn't it? I was very pleased to see one of your songs that you had today talking about joy, because I thought, I don't think this sermon is very joyful. Before I even went, hi, sorry.
Yes, thank you. Rosemary, is that working?
Yeah.
Just one comment first. I think part of our fortress mentality in Australia is because we can. We're an island, and we're not adjacent to any other country where people can cross the border fairly easily. So geography does help us with that fortress mentality. But anyway, I have got a question. The issue of the shortage of workers on farms has been bugging me for a very long time. And my sister lives in Leeton and is very active in the refugee program there. You've probably heard of Leeton and their abattoir project.
Yes, yeah.
And I asked her why we couldn't put refugees on farms, because a lot of farms have accommodation anyway, or they're crying out for backpackers, they've got accommodation for backpackers. So why can't they be put on farms to do some work rather than being locked up in detention and all the horrible things that leads to? And her reply was that their visas would not allow it. Now, I didn't understand that. Can you explain what that means?
Well, there's a few things that are maybe slight misunderstandings there. People can get CHEV visas, which means they can work outside of the cities and for some period of time, and that can act towards a credit for them to then move on to a more permanent visa. So there is a possibility for that, but you've got to have work rights in the first place. So at CARAD, we've still got people who have had their work rights removed or never been granted them. And it's weird for people, for a previous government who thought that everybody should work for everything, and, you know, all the checks and balances on people receiving welfare support and the things that they have to do. So, but some of those people have still not got work rights, and one of the reasons that they wanted to limit those work rights was because people would send almost all of their money back to their families in these insecure places that I mentioned earlier. It's very perverse. But there is the possibility, there are some people who are able to do that, and it does take a community and a community council and support from the community council in order to bring those things, those policies to the fore.
I just wonder how we've changed over the years, because I'm old enough to remember after the Second World War and the thousands and thousands of refugees came, and I actually married one of them. but my father's a pastor of the Lutheran Church and, of course, the German roots. Mm. And so our church just exploded with people coming, and thankfully Dad could speak German. Now these people have built their own homes. Yeah, and no one seemed to worry then. They were sent to camps first, then they worked for the government for 2 years and built railways and everything. And I can't remember the backlash so much. So why the backlash so much now? Is it colour or what? I don't know.
Possibly. It's possibly the racism stuff, but as part of the campaign that was mounted in the early 2000s to dissuade Australia from wanting to be supportive of refugees, Philip Ruddock went to the Federation of Ethnic Community Council Australia gathering, so an Australia-wide gathering, and I had had an invitation to be there, and one of the things the Ethnic Communities Council raised with him was, we can't be this ungenerous to refugees, because many of us either come from this background ourselves or have had parents who come from this background ourselves. And he got up and he said, I don't want to demonise him, but I probably do, but anyway, forgive me. He said, you know, the more refugees we let in, the less of your families can come here to join you. And it was a horrendous piece. But, of course, that, because family reunion is so important to people of first generation Australians or migrant Australians, it's so critical to people. It's so hard to get somebody from your family here. You have to have, you know, many thousands of dollars in the bank, and you have to be able to prove that you can support the family members. Because it was already hard enough at that time. But to have this other layer, it was a continuation of the othering policy of the government of that time. And sadly, we believed that across Australia. That went like wildfire across the ethnic councils. So it disempowered voices or people stopped saying, as a broad community action then, that we should take more refugees to a wide extent, because up until then the ethnic communities were speaking very loudly and very strongly. Now they've moved back to that position, but it frightened people. They were so frightened that they wouldn't be able to bring their elderly mother or their elderly father or their single sister somewhere in a very difficult place to live when you have got no supportive family around you here to be with them. And it was a disgusting piece of public policy. But anyway.
Thanks very much. I suppose part of us wanting to be a solution would be to have solutions to offer. So if you can think of it, you know, any things you can say are practical things that we can actually do, or where to point our activism.
Yes.
And that sort of comes from hearing the experience of, post-war migrants. I grew up in a hotel in Norseman in the 50s, and we had about, in those days, 40 bedrooms, and we had about three rooms for resident staff, so the yardmen and the kitchen hands and people like that. So we had a yardman that was an Italian refugee, an orphan, a lady from Poland, someone else from Yugoslavia. And it was ideal work because they had somewhere to live, and the domestic nature of the work was very easy to translate. My mother used to draw little stick person drawings to sweep the floor. And everyone knew what to do. And they learnt English and the culture within a working environment that was quite busy in a hotel and in the middle of the town, and went on to better things. And the local politician used to help source people from Perth and send them to us, saying, this person will be good. So maybe that's the sort of thing we should be doing again.
Yes, indeed. So there is a scheme now where you can sponsor people to come to Australia. It's a very minor scheme, and they do it in Canada quite consistently. It's a very big scheme there where a group of people get together and sponsor a refugee or a refugee family and bring them to Australia and take responsibility for, whichever bits of it is. But I think there are two things that we can lobby for, which are useful things to lobby for. You've got all disparate local members, I suppose, have you? But anyway, if you've got a Labor or a Teal person in your electorate, you can go and have a meeting with them and say, this is something that's burning for me. It's a burning issue that we really ought to get all of the remaining people who are on temporary protection visas, permanent visas, so that then they've got a pathway to, when they've got a permanent visa, they can bring their families who are in these insecure places, dangerous places, often dying before they can even get here, so that they can bring their own families here, so they can sponsor their own families here. And the other thing is, people who are on bridging visas, they're arbitrary. It's just a load of rubbish. And if you look on the CARADS website, you can see the full story and get all the information and talk to your local Member of Parliament and lobby them, because they take so much more notice of real people in their front of their faces than they do about churches or CARADS and the other do-gooders, latte-sipping people. I didn't mention the Chardonnay, but, Yes, so, these are things that make a difference to politicians. And one of the things that's kind of disappointing is it's not a major priority of the government to take on refugees at the moment, the new government. It's not a major, because they don't want a huge fight. Now they want to do the things that they know they can win. And they don't want to use up all their political capital on refugees, which in itself is another piece of racism and othering. But that is frankly where they're at. So I'm really hoping and praying that this new Labor government doesn't disappoint us again.